on to the second paper, that the present presenter is not here. One of his family members was hospitalized. I was sent his paper yesterday evening, and I have to say I spent a couple of hours trying to copy edit it. In that form, I could not have presented it here. So I'm not taking responsibility for the content, but I tried to tidy up the grammar and the style. So who is not here is Samuel Manzoni, who studied at the University of Bologna and wrote his MS thesis on Solzhenitsyn, Shostakovich and the Soviet musical censorship between 1934 and 44. And he is now working on the first Italian translation of Solzhenitsyn's selected writings on music and musicians. We will not be taking questions, also because of the time, and also because I'm just reading this. So the title is Solzhenitsyn's Heredity. There should be an H at the beginning of this word. In Italian, it's fine with E, but in English, it's with an H. So Solzhenitsyn's Heredity, how to make a symphony from Beethovenian interpretation and Shakespearean ideology. The promulgation on the 23rd of April 1932 of the resolution on the reconstruction of literary and artistic organizations by the Communist Party's Central Committee proved a fateful turning point in the fortunes of Soviet composition, soon leading to enforced conformity with the Marxist-Leninist aesthetic of socialist realism. The application of this doctrine to musical creativity posed formidable problems, especially with respect to the vexing question of how large-scale instrumental compositions, such as a symphony, could most satisfactorily convey appropriate ideological content. Resolving this difficulty was an urgent task for composers and theorists, given the high level of importance officials attached to the genre. Many musicologists try to explore the notable attempts at producing theoretical models for socialist realist symphonism, and explore the implications of these models for Soviet symphonic composition and music criticism. In spite of the claim that cultural bureaucrats, such as Andrei Zhdanov, brought about a wholesale aesthetic regression, an examination of the contemporary Soviet musicological discourse suggests that composers and theorists alike were deeply invested in preserving complex and sophisticated traditions of instrumental music from degradation and trivialization under ideological pressures. In February 1935, the Composers' Union of the USSR held a three-day congress in Moscow entitled Discussions on Soviet Symphonism. The participants included leading composers, among them Shostakovich, Kabalevsky, and Shevalin, as well as prominent theorists and musicologists such as Ivan Solzhenitsyn and Georgi Kubov. The discussions at this event were fraught with considerable consequence, especially with regard to the future viability of the instrumental symphony as an art form in the Soviet Union. The transcripts of the conference revealed concern on the part of several key participants to find ways in which Soviet symphonists could satisfy the fundamental and non-negotiable requirement of socialist realism, the conveying of ideological content, without being obliged to write program symphonies or incorporate vocal settings of political texts. Ivan Solzhenitsyn affirmed that a symphony should occupy a central position in Soviet music, claiming that native composers were the true heirs of Beethovenian symphonic traditions, which had lapsed into decadence in the West. As a genre that offered the possibility of making large-scale artistic statements imbued with, this is also in quotation marks, existential philosophical content, it was an eminently suitable vehicle for creative engagement with the great theme of the October Revolution and its world historical implications, as expounded in Marxist-Leninist philosophy, just as Beethoven's symphonies had purportedly embodied immortal images of revolutionary struggle inspired by the French Revolution. The most appropriate means of conveying this content, they argued, was not through recourse to devices such as explicit programs, but by means of musical material that evoked the lofty ethical traits of the Soviet man through its intonational character, and at the same time suggested heroic, life-affirming conflict through its musical treatment. In a notable series of essays that included The Problem of Symphonism, 1929, On Soviet Symphonism, 1935, and Historical Types of Symphonic Dramaturgy, 1941, Solzhenitsyn attempted to formulate how a heroic Soviet symphonism might develop and how it could attempt to fulfill socialist realist aesthetic criteria. Of particular interest is his suggestion that Soviet symphonists should derive inspiration from Shakespeare and seek to evoke the character traits evinced by the heroes of his plays, who supposedly possessed the kind of exalted ethical qualities necessary to combat capitalist ideological decadence. This paper will consider this aspect of Soleptinsky's thinking, examining how this vision of Shakespearean symphonism was conceived as a Soviet continuation of Beethovenian traditions. If we consider important the musicological criticism of Ivan Soleptinsky, we also need to get to know the thinking of Alexander Smirnov in order to offer an insight into the ideas that motivated the two critics in discussing the reconstruction of the symphonic language in the Soviet Union. But to understand the importance of this duality between musicological and literary criticisms, respectively, it is necessary to explain the significance of the word concealed. Because there are slides, and I was told that Gerger Loch would hit those. For the first time I saw a slide annotation, that's how. So we need to explain the significance of the word concealed. Concealed is an adjective that derived from the Latin word concelare. Con, that is completely, and celare, that is hide. Concelare means completely hide, to completely hide. So, completely hidden is the intrinsic nature of Shakespeare's characters and forms a crucial part of the ideological process that is left behind by Soviet composers after the imposition of socialist realism in 1932. Hiding implies the necessity to slough off something without saying anything. The literary critic Alexander Smirnov, following Marxist principles, draws a distinction between the sociological and the political factors in Shakespeare's production. In his paper, Shakespeare, a Marxist Interpretation, he divided the Shakespearean plays into three phases. One, the plays between 1592 and 1599 are usually considered aristocratic in their thematic material. Second, the period between 1600 and 1609 introduces the substantial bard's tragedies and coincides with the last years of Elizabeth's reign, as well as the first years of James Stuart, while in the third phase, from 1609 to 1611, the heroic struggle presented in the first and second periods loses some of its vigor and color. Nevertheless, we must elucidate in a few words the conceptual changes in Shakespeare's words. Throughout the first period, his creative process reflected a daring and happy affirmation of life along two lines: the assertion of the new absolutist national state in the Chronicle plays, and a series of enchanting comedies. In the second period, the grave political cleavage of Great Britain caused a spiritual conflict in the author's creativity, and his philosophy became tragic. Despite the austerity of these plays, we are actually at slide five. I'll just drop that because it's not consistently given where I should turn the pages. In the second period, the grave political cleavage of Great Britain caused a spiritual conflict in the author's creativity, and his philosophy became tragic. Despite the austerity of these plays, virtually all of them ends on a note of courageous affirmation of life and heroic struggle. var nog tänkt så där kan jag ta den om jag eller kan ta på. Anyway, so these end on a note of courageous affirmation of life and heroic struggle, even if this struggle ends in defeat. Finally, in the third period, tragic tension yields to a captivating, though disturbing, activity and a cheerful ending typical of tragical comedies. Slide 6, it says. This paper will aim, in particular, to elaborate on the second period, the period of tragedies. As mentioned above, the political, social and cultural context changes here, and Shakespeare bases his works on what we might call the, I quote, driving history factor. Slide 7. I introduce this term in my paper that entitled Soleptinsky and the Problem of European Symphony. Gustav Mahler, an example to follow, So in this paper, I referred at the necessity in the creative process of Soviet composers to edify, starting from a literary image. In Mahler, if Mahler represents in Soleptinsky's words, Dostoevsky of music, we should not be surprised to find strong analogies with Shakespeare's subjects and their musical representation by Soviet critics. Tragedies like Hamlet, King Lear, Macbeth, or Coriolanus start from the historical background and reach into a dimension made of heroic and moral identities. In fact, the characters come to a point where their consciousness rises and tends to destroy the sociological system that surrounds them. These humanist heroes are the representatives of an epoch that Engels defined as the most important for the revolution of mankind, because it expounded a new morality, a new philosophy, and new ideology in juxtaposition with feudalism's inner workings. In the second period, Shakespeare broke the circle of superficial and aristocratic emotions and presented brilliant comedies and an idealized portrayal of the past. The driving history factor represents nobility, which, with the support of monarchy, was preparing to defend its position against the imminent onslaught of the bourgeoisie and the gentries. It is not difficult to imagine the reason why Shakespeare introduced his powerful tragedies and developed the heroic idea of bourgeois humanism in contrast with the historical background. But to fully realize the connection between literature and music, it is necessary to examine the musical analysis of Soleptinsky. Written in 1939, the paper Shakespeare and the World of Music tries to explore the connections between the British playwright's pieces and European music. After a brief introduction, which underlines the importance of a Shakespearean interpretation of music, Soleptinsky mentions the work of the German critic Otto Ludwig. Ludwig's book entitled Shakespeare Studien, slide 8, I don't know the text well enough to find my way back to it. Well, yes, Ludwig's title entitled Shakespeare Studien suggests that the structural principle of Shakespearean plays can be derived from their relationship with music. Soleptinsky writes, I quote, "The dramatic function of Iago and Othello in the development of the tragedy is similar to the counterpoint of Sebastian Bach's fugues. Otto Ludwig reads the characters' contrast and the theatrical events in Shakespeare's plays on a purely symphonic level. Ludwig carefully studied the Shakespearean plays and established, mostly persuasively, in some cases with some stretching, the identity of Shakespearean dramaturgy and symphonic music." Unquote. In Ludwig's words, we can note how the concealed elements work on a musical and literary substratum. The close relationship is possible because one language is influenced by another through contact. In this specific case, by the language of music. The parallelism between Shakespeare and music go back to many theories of 19th and 20th centuries, and Pauline Fairclough has pointed out that, I quote, "The veneration of figures like Shakespeare, Dickens and Balzac, and the creation of Soviet musical icons, such as Beethoven and Tchaikovsky, were closely related," unquote. By analogy, at the plenary session of the Central Committee of the Union of Soviet Composers, Soleptinsky used Shakespeare as an example to offer an exhaustive interpretation of Beethovenian symphonism, since the latter can be defined as 1. An objective representation of reality, 2. A drama made by many characters, and 3. polyphonic in the sense that it combines a lot of personalities. The symphonies of Beethoven are based not on a monological, but rather on a dialogical principle. In fact, Soleczynski defined this kind of symphonism as Shakespearean and contrasted it with a Byronic type, slides 9 and 10. In which the inner struggle and the ethics social ideals are presented like a self-celebration of the author. That is, Soleczynski articulates a distinction between symphonism as a creative process, Shakespeare, Beethoven, and symphonism as a genre, Byron, Liszt. He describes it as a collective phenomenon that is based on contemporary themes and is able to satisfy the sociological factor. He writes, I quote, "The true symphonism always reappears, like heroism, when the young classes start to create an entire culture. Beethoven was a case in point," unquote. In Soviet criticism, Beethoven represents the artistic culmination of ideological ideals, the apex of heroic development, in the context of society, and the perfect combination of symphonic music based on revolutionary concepts. So, in the writings of Smirnov and Soleczynski, we can note the importance of Shakespeare and Beethoven both in literature and music. If we combine these elements in an interdisciplinary approach, they could be used as a metaphorical guideline to understand the necessities of Soviet cultural creation. In fact, on the one hand, there is need to rebuild everything from scratch, and on the other hand, to take the formative elements of European culture and reshape them in a socialist way. I shall call the second part of this paper, it's worrying, The Importance of Being Hamlet, the cases of Shostakovich and Prokofiev. Why Hamlet? Because Hamlet represents one of the most controversial characters in Shakespeare's production and was strongly criticized by the party. Nevertheless, with a deeper insight, we can note some connections with the music of Soviet composers. In fact, to quote Richard Taruskin, socialist realism could mean heroic classicism with a return to clear-cut classical structures and genres after the self-indulgences of modernist experimentation. So Beethoven's image, that was firmly based on his 3rd, 5th, and 9th symphonies, became a model for strengthening the heroic spirit of Soviet people. During the classical era, the key of C minor was rarely used. Beethoven, however, chose to write a much larger proportion of his works in this key because it represented a stormy, heroic atmosphere and symbolized the heroic character. This Beethovenian C minor mood that found its canonical essay in the 5th symphony acquired great semantic significance. In fact, in Soviet Russia, the C minor key became one of the most used tonalities in symphonic music. Slide 11. See, for example, Boris Arapov, symphony number 1. I guess we should see a list of these works I'm mentioning. See, for example, Boris Arapov's symphony number 1, 1947, Dmitri Shostakovich's symphony number 4, 1936, and number 8, 1943. And Dmitri Kabalevsky, Symphony No. 2, 1934, and No. 4, 1956. Furthermore, after the October Revolution, the compositions based on Shakespeare's plays were the following. This is slide 12. And this we should see because it is not given in the text. I'm sorry, I didn't get the slide, so I didn't see that. Sorry?
Correct.
It's fine. I shall now offer an alternative reading of Hamlet's musical development and stylistic trajectory in Soviet Russia. One of the most interesting Stalin-era Hamlets was a 1932 Moscow production directed by Nikolai Akimov, which was both farcical and politically bold. Akimov turned the question, to be or not to be, from a musing upon life or death into a question of whether or not Hamlet should try to take a throne from Claudius. The ghost was a fabrication of an ambitious Hamlet, and Ophelia's death was linked to her alcoholism. Shostakovich produced music for this play to support its irreverent tone. We can observe how the nature of his composition reflects feudal elements as well as heroic struggle. It is interesting to note how the composer introduces the tonality of C minor in the poisoning scene, slide 13. During the description, I quote Shakespeare, "The queen returns, finds the king dead, and makes passionate action," unquote. The music introduces a C minor key. Some lines earlier, Hamlet was talking with Ophelia and said, I quote again, O heavens, died 2 months ago and not forgotten yet. Then there's hope a great man's memory may outlive his life half a year. End quote. So this sometimes earlier Hamlet was talking to Ophelia and was referencing to the murdered king with these words. This metaphorical exposition of Hamlet's humanist spirit creates an internal tension between the musical representation and the stage action. We could imagine this music versus theatre conflict from a different point of view. On the one side, an ironical representation of the decay of feudalism, fratricide, and on the other side, a new heroic identity. The play was extremely popular with audiences, but after a highly critical article in Pravda, the production was moved from the capital to Leningrad. Akimov's Hamlet was the last Moscow production of the play until after Stalin's death. It seems to have only been played in theatres removed from major centres of political life. In this case, however, the move to Leningrad was reflecting the political struggles inside the party. The Leningrad party secretary was Sergei Kirov, one of Stalin's rivals, and it would have been Kirov who approved the production's reappearance in Leningrad. The story gets even more interesting as ghoulish parallels emerge between Kirov's and Hamlet's stories. In 1934, Kirov was assassinated. Stalin's involvement was suspected, since this was a time of purges in which Stalin eliminated, in one way or another, all of his potential enemies. Stalin went to the funeral and kissed Kirov's corpse, much like Claudius falsely mourned old Hamlet's accidental death. These events, and a tacit ban on the play due to Stalin's evident dislike of it, bring to mind the 18th century prohibition of the play because of its correspondence to contemporary political events surrounding Tsarist succession. But why does Shostakovich introduce the tonality of C minor? And why in representation of Hamlet's behavior? The Hamlet film score may shed light on this as well. In fact, we find stylistic analogies with the monologue of Hamlet in the movie of Grigory Kozintsev. This scene spans 3 minutes in the film, beginning just after minute 46. Instead of being in the castle, as we read in the play, Hamlet is placed outside of the castle walls, where he is walking along the shore, looking at the waves crashing against the rocks. As in the other Hamlet's cues, three times in the movie, slide 14, the clarinet plays the theme. Yes, this is one. The clarinet plays the theme, and although it is a complete statement, the theme, instead of ending an octave higher, ends on the same pitch on which it began. There's no sound example. So, furthermore, Hamlet gets more proof of the ghost's claims, since his theme takes on a few characteristics that bring it closer to the leitmotif of the ghost. Hamlet's theme is accompanied by quarter notes in the strings. These notes are played piano, and after the conclusion of the first thematic statement, they are no longer vertical sonorities, but unison pitches on all instruments. At the same time, a new theme arises in the horns and the harp. The thematic group, shown in the example, slide 15.
Oh, there is a sound example.
There is a sound example. Shall we? We must be extremely out of time. I'm guessing. Yeah. Furthermore, Hamlet gets more proof of the ghost's claims, since his theme takes on a few characteristics that bring it closer to the leitmotif of the ghost. Hamlet's theme is accompanied by... Sorry, I read until this next slide. Fine. So, it is interesting to note how the analogies between Hamlet and the ghost theme are represented in the most famous passage that Shakespeare ever wrote. At the same time, it is possible that Shostakovich focused his attention on the process through which the Danish prince turns into a heroic fighter. The gloomy sound of the clarinet in the low register, the unhurried, seemingly restrained development of the adagio melody, the gradual transition from a tragic world to lucidity. All this was designed to show the heroes coming to an understanding of the necessity of fighting for resistance. And now there is slide 6, which is 16, which is supposed to be a movie clip. Haydn. So then we go to the conclusion. I have tried to give a highlight of the works of Smirnov and Soletjensky, because I believe that we are facing an incredible interdisciplinary approach. Comparing literary and musical features uncovers unusual elements, helping us to understand the complexities of Soviet criticism. These bacilli, these embryos of cultural Sovietization that we can find in every musicological field, show the necessity to persist towards our goal, scientific research. With the hope that this paper has met the academic curiosity, I will conclude with a quote from the Shakespearean play, The Merchant of Venice. I quote, "The man hath no music in himself, nor is not moved with concord of sweet sounds. Is fit for treasons, stratagems, and spoils. The motions of his spirit are dull as night, and his affections dark as Erebus. Let no such man be trusted." And so this is the end of the